This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The first modern media superstar is how Charles Lindbergh has been described by his biographer, A. Scott Berg. Lindbergh is most famous for two things. He became a hero in 1927 when he made the first successful flight across the Atlantic. And he became a victim in 1932 after his infant son was kidnapped and killed in what was called the crime of the century. Over the years, Lindbergh and his family worked hard to protect their privacy. Before his death in 1973, he stipulated that his papers should remain private until 50 years after the death of his widow, Ann Morrow Lindbergh. In spite of that, Scott Berg contacted Ann Morrow Lindbergh with a request for access to the family papers for a biography he hoped to write. She was finally so impressed with Berg, she gave him access to her husband's papers and her own. Berg is the author of biographies of editor Maxwell Perkins and film mogul Samuel Goldwyn. I asked Scott Berg to describe why Lindbergh's transatlantic flight was so remarkable in 1927.
This was, well, not only was it a fantastically long way to go in a short time. I mean, not only was this the greatest demonstration to date of what aviation could do, but this was really the first moment in which a single human being left the Earth. There was no contact with this one human being. Again, Columbus, many thought, was gonna just float off the edges of the Earth. But he was not alone. Lindbergh was out there alone. And there was that period where he had flown up from, he left from Roosevelt Field in Long Island. He went up to the coast of Canada. And then for about 15 hours, he was flying into just black night, terrible weather, and he was out of visual and audio contact with every human being on Earth. So this, in that moment, he was suddenly elevated to godlike status. And then, 15 hours later, he is spotted for the first time coming over Ireland and rejoining the human race. And, of course, by the time he did actually land at Le Bourget in Paris, he did become a god in that instant. So it was an act of great, great heroism. It was death-defying, and he pulled it off. And above and beyond that, it was scientifically a wonder in that he who had lost his bearings several times through the flight, his compasses went out because he flew through magnetic storms and so forth, when he finally hit the other side, he was 3 miles off course. So this was just astounding that this could be done. And of course, in the historical sense, he, in that one instant, in that 33.5-hour flight, shrunk the world.
Now, he became quite a celebrity after the flight, and from the way you describe it in your book, it was a combination of things. It was the importance of the feat that he had just accomplished, and it was also the place that he held within the rise of mass media.
Yes, I think that there's no doubt about that. I mean, the accomplishment was fantastic in and of itself, but it was that moment, too, where radio had really reached its maturity, where we had all sorts of processes for sending photographs through cables and so forth. We had motion pictures, and in fact, for the first time, 1927, they were synchronizing sound with film. And in fact, the first sound newsreel was of Lindbergh taking off at Roosevelt Field. So within 2 days, films could be sent around the world, and everybody instantaneously, simultaneously, could share in that experience. They could actually see and hear Lindbergh's plane taking off. Now, on top of that, he was one of the most photogenic men who ever lived. In all my research, I've seen thousands, 5,000, 10,000 photographs of Charles Lindbergh. I've never seen one bad shot of him. I mean, he was just impossibly handsome, and he was young. He was 25, and it was at a moment when America was really hitting its stride. You know, it was a few years after World War I where we had really achieved our place in the world. I mean, there we were, having saved the free world and so forth. So here was this fantastic embodiment of America, of youth, and of all the possibilities of aviation.
The media attention, the celebrity, enormously changed Lindbergh's life. And now, I mean, for people who are always in the public eye, one of the questions is, where is that dividing line between private life and public life? And that was an issue for the Lindberghs, too. When Charles Lindbergh met Anne Morrow and they became a couple, there was an enormous amount of public interest in them. Why was there so much interest in them as a couple, and how did they deal with that?
Well, and again, you've really hit on something extremely important, which, because of all this frenzy after Lindbergh's flight, he really did become the first human quarry for the press. We didn't have the phrase paparazzi then, but it was the first time the paparazzi did cross that line. Even movie stars who existed before that, they were protected by studios, and there was a certain code of ethics. And also, people knew the movie stars weren't really the people they portrayed on the screen. Lindbergh was the real thing. So indeed, from that night he landed in Paris, all rules were broken. All rules were thrown out the window, in fact. And he was literally stalked from that day forward. So suddenly, here's this handsome young bachelor who loves his mother, and ultimately he falls in love. It was a kind of storybook meeting with one of the daughters of the American ambassador to Mexico, Dwight Morrow, and this great story unfolded in the press. Everybody loved it. Lindy was falling in love. And he fell in love with a very attractive woman, and she was a poetic woman. I mean, she was really good copy. They looked good together. He was a foot taller than she. He came from the world of science and aviation and machines, and she was this lovely poet. So everything just sort of worked for them. So indeed, the media went crazy for that. It was another thing to sell papers with.
Scott Berg is my guest, and we're talking about his new biography of Charles Lindbergh. Let's get to the kidnapping. You found the nurse, Betty Gao, who cared for the Lindbergh baby and discovered that he was missing.
I did. It was a rather, well, I was going to say rather touching. It was more than that. It was an extremely dramatic moment when I found her, and she agreed to see me very reluctantly because she really hasn't talked about the Lindbergh case in 65. Well, at that point, it was 60 years she hadn't talked about it. And it was very difficult for her because she was indeed the caretaker of that baby, and so she loved the baby. And she was the first person to discover the baby was missing. But worst of all, she became the first suspect. And for many years, people assumed she had done it or had been in on it. And so her life, I mean, she was just a girl. She was 19 or 20 years old when she came over to this country, a rather shy Scotswoman herself. And suddenly, here her entire life is plastered on the front page of every newspaper in the world. And it petrified her. And ultimately, she went back to Scotland and indeed sought a rather quiet, reclusive life. She just wanted to get back to being herself.
What did you learn from the Lindbergh papers about what went through Charles and Anne Morrow Lindbergh's minds during the period when their child was missing and the hunt was on?
Yes. For me, the most interesting aspect of that period, going through their papers, was to see how it affected the marriage. And I've been told by people who have been through tragedies that it either brings the married couple closer together or it tears them apart. I think in the case of the Lindbergh kidnapping, it did both, actually. During the period while the baby was missing and for the next year or two after that, there was a great kind of foxhole mentality between Charles and Anne that really did bring them together. But after the kidnapping, it was something Lindbergh never wanted to deal with, never talk about. And it always plagued Anne Lindbergh that she never saw her husband cry, that she felt he never properly mourned over this tragedy that had struck both of them, certainly. And as a result of that, she always felt, and in fact a psychiatrist she later saw always felt, that there was this buried trauma there. And it became a kind of wedge, or more than that, it became almost a cancerous growth that got bigger and bigger. And in the later years of the Lindbergh marriage, they were separated for weeks, sometimes months at a time, and never really talked about. And I think she thinks that a lot of it goes back to 1932, when this tragedy was never properly dealt with.
Bruno Hauptmann was convicted of the Lindbergh kidnapping. His widow maintained his innocence to the last. And she spent a lot of time trying to convince journalists, often successfully, to reinvestigate, to write stories and so on. I'm sure you did a little bit of reinvestigating yourself. What did you walk away thinking?
I did, and indeed I spent an afternoon with Mrs. Hauptmann herself. And she agreed to the interview, I think for the reason that she hoped I would join her cause. And in fact, she asked me point blank if I would go to the governor of New Jersey to get him to reopen the case. And indeed, when I met her and when I started this project, it was a fervent hope of mine that I would find enough evidence to clear Bruno Richard Hauptmann. And I really pored over everything I could find with that hope. Unfortunately, the deeper I got into the case and the more I studied the evidence and the more I read the transcripts and everyone's statements and so forth, and I really spent a lot of time on all the evidence, the guiltier he came up.
What did you think his motive was?
I think his motive was money. I don't think he intended to kill the baby. I think that was an accident. I think that happened when he was leaving the child's nursery on the second floor, coming down a ladder. There was a bit of a gap between the window and the ladder. I think he put too much weight on the ladder. He also had the added weight of the baby. The ladder did break. We know that. You can see that it is split. And I think the baby either cracked his head against the wall of the house or actually fell to the ground, was dropped to the ground, and his skull was smashed then. So that part was an accident, but I think what he hoped to gain was $50,000 in ransom, and it would have been neat and clean. He would have returned the baby right away.
My guest is Scott Berg. He's written a new biography of Charles Lindbergh. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with Scott Berg about his new biography of Charles Lindbergh. During part of the period that you were writing and researching your biography of Charles Lindbergh and the kidnapping, which became known as the crime of the century, the O.J. trial was underway, also being billed as the crime of the century. And I can think of a connection between the two trials, the trial of Bruno Hauptmann and the trial of O.J. Simpson, and that's cameras in the courtroom. Tell the story of cameras in the court in the Lindbergh kidnapping trial.
Yes, and I would say, I was writing those chapters while the O.J. trial was going on, and I thought, oh, if all you news people today only really knew, I mean, the real crime and trial of the century really did happen back in the 30s. And indeed, all the models for what went on during the O.J. trial, such as cameras in the courtroom and basically court television. I mean, they didn't have court TV then, but they had court radio, basically. They had radio announcers constantly reporting at noon and doing interviews with people and with experts and so forth. All that began at the Lindbergh trial, as indeed did cameras in the courtroom. There was a camera hidden in the courtroom. It was a stationary camera. It did not move. It was focused on the witness chair. It's a strange thing because it was such a big, bulky camera. It is hard to believe that people didn't know it was there, but nobody ever copped to knowing it was there. And indeed, after a few days of trial testimony, film footage began to appear in movie houses, in theaters, as parts of newsreels. And from that moment, the instant they did appear, the judge pulled them and pulled the camera from the courtroom because everyone immediately saw how that film footage could be used to sway certainly the public and indeed whether that might trickle down to the jury as well, barred though they were from reading newspapers and so forth.
Did it seem to be affecting public opinion?
Oh, there's no question it was affecting public opinion. And Bruno Richard Hauptmann...
In which direction?
Well, it was against Hauptmann, who suffered primarily because, first of all, he was a German immigrant, and he did not have complete mastery of the English language. And, of course, Germans were still considered somewhat suspicious. It wasn't that many years after the First World War. Indeed, immigrants of any kind were always held in some suspicion. So to see and hear Hauptmann, this was troubling. And he had a somewhat bumbling attorney, And so to see him, that didn't play very well. And there, on the other hand, you would see Charles Lindbergh. I mean, just to see Lindbergh himself, who was this bastion and vision of strength and goodness, to see Anne Lindbergh on the stand, you know, this frail, you know, she was still in her 20s when this happened. She was 25 when the crime happened, 28 when the trial occurred. So to see this rather small, frail woman who had obviously been crying, well, this could not but sway public opinion.
By the way, when you say the camera was hidden in the courtroom, the judge knew it was there, didn't he?
Yes, presumably he did. So it was there that everyone had agreed that a camera could be in the courtroom, but it was not to be used during the actual testimony. That is, when court broke, the camera could be used to film some of the principals. And indeed, some of the attorneys, for example, when court was not in session, would go before the camera and actually reenact some of the things they had said. So that in and of itself contributed to the whole falsity of the operation. And that was yet another reason why cameras were really removed from courtrooms all across the country from that moment on.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Scott Berg, and we're talking about his new biography of Charles Lindbergh. Now, you and I were both warned about protecting ourselves against kidnapping as children, largely because of the Lindbergh kidnapping. What impact did the Lindbergh kidnapping have on Charles and Anne Morrow Lindbergh's approach to protecting their children? What did you get from that, from the papers that you had access to?
Yes, the papers were very revealing in that regard. Because Lindbergh was of two minds. On one hand, he was extremely protective. And in fact, he was protective of his family his entire life. It was part of the reason I think he wanted the papers, his own papers, locked up so that nobody could bother his family for 50 years after his death and so forth. But the interesting thing, the flip side is he was not going to become paranoid about it. And it was as though he was not going to become a victim of the crime twice. And what amazed me is when the second child was born, which was just a few months after the kidnapping, shortly after that, he suddenly took Anne on a trip, a flying trip around the world that lasted for months. So for months at a time, he and Anne suddenly left their baby alone. With a nurse or with her mother, sometimes with his mother, but off they went. And it was almost as though he were saying to his wife, this is what I felt rather strongly, we are not going to become paranoid here, and we've got to get on with our lives, and we must just assume this will not happen again. We must protect ourselves as best we can, but that must not change the way we live in a basic way. And off they went. And it was amazing to me that after the birth of each child, Lindbergh did that same drill.
Well, it's almost as if, excuse me for the cheap psychoanalysis here, but it's almost as if what he really was saying was, this time around, we're not going to allow ourselves to become very attached to the infant. We're going to, like, get away and not have this emotional attachment.
I think there's some truth to that. I definitely do. And the Lindbergh children all grew up feeling very loved, but never cosseted by any means. And I think there was always some detachment between parents and children.
You write that your mother didn't want you to write this book about Charles Lindbergh because she thought of Lindbergh as an anti-Semite. And
it was my grandmother.
Your grandmother, excuse me. And therefore, Lindbergh was like not worth the attention. He was a scoundrel, an anti-Semite. What did you find about his degree of anti-Semitism?
Yes, and I will say this. I think my grandmother thought he was worth the attention. I think her real worry was, is that a world I wanted to spend a decade in?
Uh-huh.
My grandmother was Jewish, and she grew up in a time and a place where there was a rather sharp division between Jews and Gentiles, and we don't belong to their clubs and so forth. And I think she was wary of my invading that particular world. What I found was more and less than I expected. And it really became a great exploration for me of what is anti-Semitism. What I learned was that Charles Lindbergh was not an active anti-Semite. He did not hate Jews, if that is your definition of what an anti-Semite is. Some of his best friends were Jewish, as the phrase goes, which is an immediate tip-off to most Jews that he probably is anti-Semitic. But the truth of the matter is, Charles Lindbergh, who didn't have many friends in the world, did have several Jewish friends. He consorted with them, he worked with them, he was friends with them. Now, at the same time, that makes the very point. He did segregate them in his mind. Jews were different. And indeed, during the America First period, which was an extremely controversial period in this country's life, and it was in Lindbergh's life, he did make some references in his writings and in a speech he delivered in which he talked about the Jews as being other than Americans, as being different, as being another category of people. And in saying that, he really went against the grain of the founding fathers. He really defied what this country is about, which is the great melting pot.
Scott Berg is the author of a new biography of Charles Lindbergh. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with A. Scott Berg, the author of a new biography of Charles Lindbergh. Lindbergh is best known for making the first transatlantic flight back in 1927. His family was devastated in 1932 by what was described as the crime of the century, the kidnap and killing of the Lindbergh baby. In the late 30s, Lindbergh's heroic image was tarnished by anti-Semitic comments. For example, in a 1938 speech in Des Moines, he said this about Jews: "Their greatest danger to this country lies in their large ownership and influence in our motion pictures, our press, our radio, and our government."
And he believed that. And that was, and this is hardly to excuse him, that was a very common thought in the 30s, the 40s, and well into the 50s and 60s, in fact. The Jews control the media. I mean, we have all heard that. Lindbergh actively believed that. And he believed it primarily because he wanted to believe it. He had to believe it.
And adding to his reputation for anti-Semitism, in 1937, he described Hitler as a great man. He said, "I believe Hitler has done much for the German people." And shortly before Kristallnacht, he received a medal from Germany, which he never gave back in protest after the war started and after he realized what was actually going on there. Did he ever change his mind about Hitler after the revelations about the concentration camps and the death camps?
He really didn't. And this is one of the great downfalls, or one of the reasons for the downfall of Charles Lindbergh, too. He stubbornly adhered to everything he ever thought, said, or did. And it was admirable on one hand that he stood by his actions and record. On the other hand, he never came around. His wife did recant. She wrote, I found several things in her diaries that were never published that were indeed praising Hitler, praising Nazi Germany, and so forth. And she did retract them and say, I was really naive or I didn't want to know better. Lindbergh really was infatuated with Germany. One can understand why, and my job is never to excuse him. It's really to explain him. And I try to take you on Lindbergh's journey so that you can see what it is he fell in love with, which was this amazing technological society that was springing forward in the 30s, that had the greatest air force in the world, that seemed to be an anti-crime country and so forth. But of course, he was closing his eyes to the most horrible crimes going on of all. Now, in his defense, there was a lot we did not know about Nazi crimes then. On the other hand, there was plenty we did know. And indeed, he was given this medal, and indeed, he chose never to give it back.
In spite of Lindbergh's many aviation talents and all that he could have offered to the aviation industry during World War II, FDR banned him from participating in any of the government's war efforts. Why?
It's really one of the most interesting things to me, because I grew up a great Roosevelt lover, and I still am. I mean, I think he was a fantastic president. But what I learned putting this book together was really what a petty and manipulative and powerful politician he was at the same time. Lindbergh and Roosevelt became the two great antagonists during the 2 years before Pearl Harbor, 1940, 1941. During that period, Roosevelt very much wanted this country to get into the war. Lindbergh was the primary spokesman to keep us out of the war. And they would give dueling speeches. Roosevelt would give a fireside chat, and some of the country would come over to him. Then Lindbergh would go out and give an address on behalf of America First, and the country would trot toward him. And indeed, as late as the spring and into the summer of 1941, this is now 6 months, and even really up until 3 months before Pearl Harbor, most of the country backed Lindbergh and his position. They believed this was a European war.
America First was an isolationist group.
It was an isolationist organization. When I started the book, in fact, this was one of the great surprises for me. I thought America First was started by a bunch of middle-aged, Midwestern, very Republican senators. What I learned, in fact, was that America First began as a kind of youth movement. It was an organization started by a few students at Yale Law School and Yale University, undergraduates, and a strange conglomeration of kids, basically, who were Gerald Ford, Sergeant Shriver, Potter Stewart, who of course ended up on the U.S. Supreme Court, Kingman Brewster, who became president of Yale University. So these were not rabid right-wingers. These were rather idealistic young men who believed, as Lindbergh did, that this was not an American war. Of course, everything changed with Pearl Harbor, and at that moment, Lindbergh tried to get into the war.
So was this FDR's problem with Lindbergh an ideological one, a political
yes,
one?
Yes, it was a political problem and ideological, and indeed, they had had a skirmish about 7 years earlier over the airmail. And it was a fight over canceling some airmail contracts. And it was a very public fight, and it was one that Lindbergh won. And Franklin Roosevelt had made a mistake. It was his first big public goof in the New Deal. It was in 1934. And as a result of that, he always sort of had it in for Lindbergh.
Now, Lindbergh went on to other technical accomplishments in the latter part of his life. Maybe you can briefly sum up what they were.
Well, actually, his accomplishments were really all across the board for the last 33 years of his life, most interesting of which, I think, was actually anti-technology, which is he became extremely interested in the environment and conservation. And it was quite ironic because Lindbergh himself realized that he was responsible for a lot of the problems in the environment. He, having been the great romantic symbol of aviation, which shrank the world, it occurred to him that he was responsible for a lot of the encroaching of civilization in areas where it shouldn't be encroached upon. As a result of that, animals were becoming extinct. Some remote tribes were becoming extinct, tribes of human beings, the flora, the fauna. And so he really spent the last 25 years of his life as a very active crusader trying to save the planet. He was very big on saving the whales, saving the trees. He said at one point toward the end of his life, if I had to choose between airplanes and birds, I would choose birds. And it was interesting to me, he was on the Pan Am board, and when the supersonic transport was being developed, he vocally and publicly came out against the SST. He just thought it was ecologically unsound and that it was unnecessary. And in fact, he wrote a big op-ed piece in the New York Times on the very subject. And all Lindbergh's life, he always maintained an interest in archaeology and in anthropology. So there were always, whenever I thought I could pin a label on Lindbergh or whenever I thought I knew where he was going, he would fool me. He'd make a right-hand turn and go in an entirely different direction.
I think one thing our society is trying to come to terms with now is the fact that a lot of people who are exceptionally gifted in one way or another, whether it's in the arts or politics, are also very flawed in one way or another, whether it's in certain views that they hold or certain ways they live their private life. And somehow, if you throw fame or celebrity into the equation, it seems to complicate things even more. And I'm wondering if writing the Lindbergh book has given you a chance to reflect on that, and if so, what kinds of conclusions you've been reaching?
Well, it has. And the first and foremost conclusion I've reached is lives are not black and white. And we all live rather gray lives, I think. And that is touched with pastels of other colors, needless to say. But nothing is black and white. Charles Lindbergh knew all along. He knew the morning after when they turned him into a god that he was, in fact, only a man. And he knew nobody could be everything to every man, and he was not. And he felt people kept trying to push him into those slots, and one cannot do that. And that has an application today about President Clinton, for that matter. He is who he is, and you know, we've got to take the whole package or reject the whole package. But that's the case, and that's as it was with Lindbergh. And I learned, for me personally, it was not to be judgmental. My job is not to pass judgment on my subjects. It is to serve up as much information is in as dramatic a fashion as I can, that information to the public, so you can decide who this person is and you can develop your own feelings about him. But I think after you read the Lindbergh book, you will have mixed feelings from beginning to end. And I think some people who have demonized him will realize he was quite an amazing man. And I think some people who have deified him will realize the same thing, that he is, alas, only a man.
Well, Scott Berg, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Scott Berg is the author of a new biography of Charles Lindbergh,